Hello, welcome along to our show. My name's Dan, this is the Fun Kids Science Weekly, the only place that guarantees you a full tour of the universe, there or thereabouts, and kind of gets you home in around about half an hour. Thank you so much for listening. This week we'll chat to someone who has won a competition set up by Disney that's trying to make the world a better place. Also, you can hear why the creator of the Labradoodle dog thinks it was the biggest mistake of his life. And we'll learn all about a disease that pretty much turns people into stone. Also, I'll answer some of your questions in just a sec. This week's they're about kangaroo pouches and why the Earth is a little bit tilted. That's on the way. First, let's catch up with one of our favourite genius making friends here on the Science Weekly. It's Sir Sidney McSprocket, talking all about how the things that you use pretty much every day are made.
How's it made?
Oh, hello. Sir Sidney McSprocket here. I've been in action, capturing facts all about manufacturing. It's for this rather special stipendiary compendium I'm compiling. You just ask it how something is made, and it'll oblige with a fulsome explanation. Now, we all love an electronic toy or two, or perhaps three or four. And where there's toys, there's frequently batteries. Handy little things. So, how are batteries made? Batteries may be small, but they're fairly complicated. Think about the ones you put in your TV remote. They're made of a small metal can, similar to the size of your little finger. Inside is a combination of chemicals which work together to produce the power we need.
Step one.
To make the body of the battery, tiny canister shapes are punched out of steel. They must be exactly the same size with no tears or creases, because that would let the chemicals out. There are therefore many checks to ensure each one is correctly made.
Step two.
Cylinder batteries often contain a metal nail which helps create the chemical reaction. Each nail must be very clean and will be tumbled in grit to make sure no dirt is clinging on.
Step three.
One of the important chemicals is zinc oxide, which arrives at the factory in huge slabs of metal. Now, it'll be a bit tricky to get those into the tiny canisters. The slabs are heated up to make either a molten liquid or a fine powder which fills the little canisters.
Step four.
Now, the zinc mustn't touch the other substances inside the battery, and so a tiny plasticky separator is inserted before the next chemical goes in.
Step five.
And that ingredient is manganese oxide, which is mixed with a secret combination of other chemicals. Once it's ready, it's added into a separate section to the zinc.
Step six.
Once all the materials are inside, a base and a cap with a dimple at the positive end of the battery are fixed onto the canister, and it's ready for packaging. As you can imagine, with all those chemicals, however curious you are, you mustn't try to look inside. Let my compendium do the hard work for you. Oh, now I must get on. But come back soon and find out more about manufacturing with my splendid stipendiary compendium.
How's it made? With support from the Royal Commission for the 1851 exhibition. Find out more at funkidslive.com.
Right, it's question time on the show. It's probably my favourite part of the Science Weekly, you know, where you send over your sciencey questions that you're so desperate to get answered, but you don't really know where to start and do all the legwork and the research. So you send it over as a review for us on Apple Podcasts, and then I become like a sciencey Sherlock for you. This is from Rai Rai Ye, who asks, "Hey Rai Rai Ye, I think you've written in before. Nice to know that you're still there and you've got so many questions that you need answered." Anyway, Rai Rai Ye says, "Why does the Earth spin on a wonky axis?" Well, the proper name for it, Rai Rai Ye, is the axial tilt, and it means that the Earth is slightly tilted by 23.44 degrees. Now, funnily enough, most planets are tilted. Uranus has an axial tilt of 82 degrees, which means it spins almost at a right angle. Now, scientists don't know exactly why that we're tilted. They think it's something to do with when the Earth was formed with the rest of the planets in the early solar system, because there was so much matter, gas, and protoplanets flying around, they think they probably collided into each other. And this was at such an early stage of the development of the planets and the Earth that it threw things off course and it gave our planet the wonky tilt. But get this, it's actually really useful. It's almost a miracle that it's happened, because the tilt gives us seasons. When we're tilted towards the sun in our elliptical orbit, we get summer. When we're tilted away, we have winter. And although the tilt, which is probably an accident, it has given Earth the perfect conditions for life. So it's a miraculous accident that we don't know if there is anywhere else in the universe. So it's pretty amazing. Thank you so much, Rai Rai Yay. Right, this is from Rebecca in West Hill in the UK, who wants to know if baby kangaroos are born with a pouch. Now, Rebecca, a newborn kangaroo, it's not really developed at all when they're born. They're born almost still like an embryo. You know, when you see a photo of a newborn baby that's not even been born yet, and it looks a little bit like a pea, a nut, and a little bit of popcorn all squashed together, kind of like alien-like. Yeah, that's what a kangaroo is like when it's born. It's really small, and it will stay like this for over a month before it will finally clamber up and then poke its head out of its mum's pouch. And it will stay there for a few months, and then occasionally it will hop out, it will bounce around, but it will always come back to the pouch for about a year. And then after 230 days, it will finally leave the pouch for the last time. Now, the thing is, Rebecca, I can't find anything definite that says they are born with a pouch, but I think that baby female kangaroos kind of have to be, really, because then it'll develop, it'll get ready over time for them to have babies themselves. So I think we've covered that one, Rebecca. Thank you so much for the question. If you've got something that you need answered on the show, you need to leave it as a review for the Science Weekly over on Apple Podcasts. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, look, you know when you're on a day out somewhere, maybe a theme park, something like that, and then you get a balloon, which is filled with helium, which helps it hang in the sky, and most of the time, if you're honest, you're accidentally let go, don't you? Well, it turns out that you getting that balloon could have a disastrous impact on medicine, because there's a helium shortage. Now, Professor David Cole Hamilton is from the University of St Andrews, and he's on the line to tell us more. Hey, David.
Hi, how are you?
Yes, very well. Thank you so much for joining us. Can we start by just talking about the properties of helium and what makes it so useful in balloons and in medical equipment?
Yeah, certainly. Helium is a gas. It's the second lightest element in terms of its weight, but also hydrogen is lighter than helium. But helium is the one. And the reason that it's used in balloons is it's very, very stable, and it floats because it's very light. It floats up in the air. If you use hydrogen, you could do the same thing, but unfortunately hydrogen is very flammable. So if you happen to have a flame near the balloon, it explodes. And it's quite fun to show that, but I don't think it's something we can do every day in the park, as you say.
What makes an element at its most basic form light? Why is it the second lightest element? And also, what makes hydrogen more flammable than all the others?
An element weight is determined by the number of protons and neutrons in its nucleus. And we start with hydrogen has one proton, and then helium has two protons and two neutrons. And so you go on and you build up gradually, and you get eventually to things like uranium, which have masses of protons and neutrons, so they're very, very heavy. And as we build up the periodic table, your readers may not have seen a periodic table, but they may have done, we gradually get heavier and heavier. And there are only 90 elements that occur naturally. And everything you see around you is made from these 90 elements. And that's an amazing thought, because we really have to look after them all. So if it's very light, it means it's got very few protons and neutrons. And helium, as I say, is the second lightest of all. The reason hydrogen is very reactive is because it has, now we have to talk about electrons, which are the other fundamental particles. A hydrogen atom has only one electron, and it would like to have two. Helium already has two, so it's very stable. And so hydrogen wants to pick up another electron, and to do that, or rather to lose an electron, either pick up or lose an electron, and that makes it very, very reactive with other things. So if you think of water, the people listening to your podcast will know that water has a formula H2O. That means it's made of two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom, and that's very stable. But a hydrogen itself burns in air to make water, and that's why hydrogen is very reactive. And it means it's a very good fuel, and actually we'll hear a lot more about hydrogen as it's made more and more for a fuel, because you can make it from water, and you don't therefore have, and when you burn it, you don't get any carbon release, so or any carbon dioxide release. So it's a non-polluting fuel. Anyway, let's go back to helium. So helium is very, very light. And the other thing about very light things is it means they boil at a very, very low temperature. And the reason helium is used in medicine is it's used to cool the magnets in MRI scanners. Now, some of the people listening to your podcast will have had an MRI scan, or they'll know people who've had an MRI scan. It's a way of looking at the body a bit like an X-ray, but it doesn't use X-rays. And the point about this MRI scan is you have to have a magnet, a very big magnet, which you put the patient into, and then you play music, where you play a sort of radio frequency to it, and various things happen, and you can get an image of the body. But this magnet has to be made with something called a superconductor. So that's like an electric wire, but it's an electric wire which has no resistance. But it only has no resistance if it's cooled very, very low. And the temperature at which liquid helium boils is 4 degrees Kelvin. So that's 4 degrees above what we call absolute zero. Absolute zero is minus 273 degrees centigrade. So 4 degrees above that, you have to cool the superconductor to below that temperature for it to have its magnetic properties. And so you have to have liquid helium to cool that magnet. Now that's the key. It's really, really important for that.
So it's an element that has all these incredible uses all around the world. Yeah. Why is there a shortage of it at the moment?
Well, helium is produced, well, two reasons. First of all, helium is produced by radioactive decay in rocks. And it is a gas, so when it's released, what happens to it, because it's so light and because it's so stable, it floats up in the atmosphere. It comes to the edge of the atmosphere, and then it's lost into space forever. So that's very important, and it's the only element that happens to, because it's so light. Hydrogen doesn't do that because it reacts before it gets there, but helium does it because it just gets to the top of the atmosphere and is lost forever. So most of the helium that's generated in these rocks underground, that's what happens to it. It goes into the atmosphere, goes up to the top of the atmosphere, and is lost to outer space. Occasionally, it's trapped in a sort of cave underground, along with other gases, sometimes with natural gas, sometimes with air. And in those cases, it's possible to collect that helium. Now, there are only three major places where there are these helium supplies. One is in Qatar, and that is closed. The place where they were selling that has closed. One is in the United States. That will close in 2021. And one is in Tanzania, which is a new find, which will start producing in 2020. And if we just use the helium in the way we do it at the moment, or for the applications we do at the moment, and we used it and got rid of it each time we used it, then there's enough for the world supply for between 8 and 12 years. Now, that's fine, because actually with the MRI scanners, we recycle the helium. We don't just use it once and then get rid of it. Also, with deep sea diving, you use helium to replace some of the nitrogen in the gas so that you don't get the bends and nitrogen narcosis, because helium doesn't dissolve in the blood, so you don't get bubbles in the blood, whereas nitrogen does dissolve in the blood, and that gives bubbles in the blood when you come up. In deep sea diving, they now recycle the helium. So the one place where rarely we use helium and we don't recycle it is in the helium balloons you described at the beginning. And if you have a helium balloon and it goes down, the helium is lost into the atmosphere, or if it pops, it's lost into the atmosphere. And that helium then goes through the process of floating up to the top of the atmosphere and is lost forever. 10% of helium is used in balloons. And so it's a very easy calculation to say that if we just carry on doing that, that 10% is lost, and that means it'll take between 80 and 120 years to lose forever into the outer space all of the helium that's in that Tanzanian reservoir. And that's really scary, because that means in 120 years we won't have helium and we won't be able to do MRI scans. There is another very serious problem about helium balloons if you have them at your party.
Of course.
And that is if you release them, they have to go somewhere. So they float somewhere and then they land. They're made of plastic. That plastic pollutes either the land or the sea. Particularly in the sea, it's a problem because marine mammals tend to eat them and then they die. And they are made from biodegradable plastic, but the biodegradation takes about a year, and it takes about 10 seconds for a marine mammal to eat one of these balloons. So that's another very serious problem, the pollution that comes from the plastic of the balloons. And one final problem is that if you have a cluster of these balloons and you let it go, last year in the United Kingdom, over 600 examples of the trains having to be stopped because balloons got caught on gantries and things happened, and some of these were dangerous. So I think when we think about this helium balloon problem, there is the problem of helium, which is very serious. But then there's also the problem of pollution, which I think we also have to take very seriously.
Now, science does so much, David. It's constantly creating new things. It's one of the reasons why we love it so much. why can't, very simply, is there a way that we can create helium?
No. It's created in the sun. I mean, the sun is powered by hydrogen fusion to helium. That's the whole, all stars, that's what happens. But we can't do that on Earth at the moment. We don't have the facility to do nuclear fusion on Earth. There's some experiments going on, of course, and that's as an energy creation, and helium may be a byproduct of that. But at the moment, we're not in a position where helium can be made by fusion.
What are we waiting on, David, very quickly? Sorry. So if we know the properties of nuclear fusion, we've got an idea of what's happening on the sun to create this helium. What are we waiting for on Earth to be able to do this? Why have we not got the capability at the moment?
Well, the problem is actually containing that nuclear fusion process, because the temperature, of course, is extremely high. The amount of energy generated is extremely high. We don't have the materials where we contain it. In the sun, it's contained by the gravity of the sun, because the sun is such an enormous body. But we don't have that. And so, as I say, there are experiments going on to try to do this, to maintain the plasma, which is doing the fusion, in some kind of magnetic field. And, you know, the Joint Torus in Oxfordshire is trying to do that, and there are other places. But so far, we're not in that position.
While I've got you, and while we're on helium, this is very quick, lastly. At parties, when you've got the balloons, you tend to, you know, open the bottom and you'll suck it in, and it'll make your voice go nice and high-pitched. Is that dangerous at all, or is that just my mum?
It depends how pure the helium is. If the helium's pure, it's not dangerous, but there are some impurities in that helium, which I think you should be very careful about. I think you shouldn't have the balloon in the first place, so you shouldn't be able to do that.
Right, okay, brilliant. Professor David Cole-Hamilton, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dan. Good to talk to you.
Now it's time for this week's Dangerous Dan, which is all about one of the strangest and rarest diseases through history, which is known as Stone Man Syndrome. Now, its proper name is fibrodysplasia ossificans progressiva, or FOP, and it's when muscles, tendons and ligaments turn into bone. Now, as I say, it's one of the rarest diseases that is around the world. It affects about 1 in 2 million people. There are no treatments and cures at the moment just yet, and it's caused by a genetic disorder. It's essentially an issue where the body's repair system, it thinks that parts of itself that aren't made of bone are made of bone, so when it gets damaged, when it gets hurt, it repairs them as if it was bone. So you start to feel muscles, tendons, things that help you move, turn into bone, and then quickly you become rigid like a statue. And it works from the top down. It starts to fuse parts of your shoulder, then your chest into bone, then it works towards your arms and your legs, and it can be dangerously fatal. Because once the muscles around the jaw turn into bone, there's no way of opening it to breathe or even to eat. It turns a person into a stone made of bones. It's the time of the year when seasons all around the world are changing from one to another. Here in the UK, we're moving from summer into autumn. So I imagine on the other side of the world, in places like Australia, you're going from winter into spring. So let's find out all about how the weather and how seasons affect our climate with Marina Ventura.
Marina Ventura's Climate Explorers.
Hi there, Marina Ventura here. I love finding out about the natural world, and that includes the Earth's climate. We know that weather can change from one day to the next, but climates can change too, over the time span of years, centuries, or even longer. So, I'm on a mission to fill MapApp with the latest climate information with the help of some awesome climate explorers. Come on then, let's go! Earth is very old. 4.5 billion years old, in fact. It can be really hard to get your head around such a big number, especially as humans have only been around for a tiny amount of that time. That said, I bet you know a bit about how life on Earth has changed. Here's a clue. You know about dinosaurs, right? Luckily, we don't need to worry about them anymore. Well, just as types of life on Earth have changed over time, so has the global climate. Come on, let's find out what's behind those changes.
You've already hit on one thing behind changes, Marina. Types of life can affect the climate. When the Earth was very young, even though there wasn't as much heat coming from the sun, the planet was very hot and gassy. And that's because there weren't any plants to absorb these gases. These gases acted a bit like a blanket and stopped the heat escaping, so air temperatures went up. As life on Earth developed, plants evolved and grew in number. As they were able to absorb gases like carbon dioxide, they helped reduce the blanket effect and cooled temperatures down. And temperatures cooled down. For the last few million years, the sun has been causing climates to change. Stars like the sun get hotter as they age, and today the Earth gets more heat from the sun than it did when life was starting to develop on our planet. And the sun itself is always changing. Giant dark spots called sunspots are always moving across its surface, causing the sun to give off slightly more energy, which makes the Earth a bit warmer.
So what else makes climates naturally change?
Well, something else that comes in cycles is all to do with the Earth's orbit, the way it moves around the sun. The shape of the orbit changes gradually from a circle to more of an oval in a cycle that lasts about 100,000 years. This makes the Earth move further away from the sun at times, so less of the sun's energy reaches the planet. The Earth also tilts as it orbits, and that tilt can be bigger at some times than others. This means that parts of the Earth become closer to the sun, and so hotter in summer, and others are further away, and so colder in winter.
So naturally, there will be cycles of different climates as the Earth's orbit changes, and as the energy the planet gets from the sun varies, as well as what kind of plants and animals are living. These are all reasons why the climate has naturally changed, and will continue to do so.
But don't forget, there are things which can affect climates which aren't related to our orbit of the sun. Remember the dinosaurs!
Good point, Mappy. You'll probably know that scientists believe the dinosaurs died out because a giant meteorite crashed into the Earth. The meteorite caused a dust cloud which blocked out the sun, causing temperatures to drop. Many living things on Earth died. Something similar happens when volcanoes erupt. Clouds of ash can fill the skies, sometimes for many years, blocking out sunlight and causing global temperatures to drop. Scientists have noticed that in the last 100 years or so, the climate has changed in other, unexpected ways. Whilst we are in the middle of a naturally warmer part of the cycle, temperatures have risen much more quickly than they have before. This is because of the effect that humans have on the environment, and it's something we'll be finding out more about.
That's right. All with the help of some real-life climate explorers. Come on, Marina. Load me up.
Good job, Mappy. See you soon, everyone.
Marina Ventura's Climate Explorers, supported by the Natural Environment Research Council, the science of the natural world. Find out more at funkidslive.com/marina.
Now, recently on the Fun Kids Science Weekly, we've been hearing all about things that kids have invented to try and change the world. And a few weeks ago at Disney, they ran a competition called Dream Big Princess, asking for ideas to make the planet a better place. And on the line, we've got the winner, Hannah from London, who is 7 years old. She invented the Magic Magnet Plastic Catcher. Hey, Hannah.
Hey.
Thank you so much for joining us. I think we should start right at the start, if that's okay. What gave you the first idea for this invention?
Well, Ariel is one of my favourite Disney characters. And I want to be eco-friendly and protect the sea creatures.
So, because you love Ariel so much, the Little Mermaid, you wanted to protect the sea creatures. How did you then think about the Magic Magnet Plastic Catcher? How did you have that idea?
Well, first I thought of, like, doing robots, but, like, that would be big and wasting, and there could only be a few. But and then I thought of making little mouths. That way there could be lots of them, and they can... There are lots of them, and they can catch the plastic.
So they're gonna roam along the sea, catching the plastic. Help me try and imagine what it's gonna look like, Hannah. Talk me through the way that it looks.
Well, it's basically an open mouth which has jagged teeth on it.
And is that it? Does it have flippers or fins to swim?
But it's made out of metal.
It's made out of metal. So it's kind of like this bin that floats around the sea with these jagged teeth to catch all the rubbish and the plastic that's there.
And they chew it up and then put it into a big box.
What happens, though, Hannah, if the worst happens and one of the sea creatures that you're trying to save gets in the way of the Magic Magnet Plastic Catcher?
It won't, because they're going to be warned by a light and a very low, deep sound.
Oh, a low, deep sound. So where is the light going to come from?
It's going to come from the Magic Magnet Plastic Catcher.
And then it's got this low, deep humming sound, like a hmm, and that's going to warn creatures that maybe can't see as well that it's on its way.
They'll go out of the place where it's catching. So where it's going, it'll make that noise, and then so the fishes won't get caught, because they'll be scared of the noise and they'll go away.
Are you always having ideas like this? Is the Magic Magnet Plastic Catcher one of hundreds of inventions that you've dreamed in your mind?
Yes. I also got another idea of an invention.
Yeah, go for it. What is it?
Like a bin which you put food in it, and then it makes it into fertiliser.
It sounds to me like you're very into bins and waste, Hannah. The Magic Magnet Plastic Catcher is a bin that floats around the sea. You've got this bin that turns food into fertiliser. What about way into the future, Hannah? Maybe a couple of years from now. Is there any other way that you would like to try and save the world?
Maybe, like, being a bit more eco-friendly. Don't waste that much food, and don't waste water and electricity. When you turn the tap on, don't leave the tap on for too long. Just wash your hands, and then when you're finished, just turn the tap off. Same with television. Once you finish watching, turn the television off. Don't forget to turn the television off. Recycle the things that can be recycled.
Amazing. Well, I'm so pleased that you're having these ideas, Hannah, to try and save the world. Thank you so much for telling us all about it on the Fun Kids Science Weekly.
Thank you.
Let's get all the science that has been all over your news this week. NASA's ICESat space laser, it's up there right now, tracking the thickness of Arctic sea ice. It was launched about a year ago to measure the shape of Antarctica and Greenland, and it can map the ice up to 40 metres down. And it's just started to collect the data, which can help scientists understand these parts of the world much better. Also, a major new United Nations report warns that climate change is devastating our seas more than ever before. A panel of scientists have said that the waters are rising, ice is melting, and species are moving habitat due to human activities. And the loss of permanently frozen lands threatens to unleash even more carbon into the air, which makes things even worse. And finally, the creator of the Labradoodle dog, which is the cross between a Labrador and a poodle, it says it's his biggest mistake. Wally Conran says that he's concerned with all the copycat crossbreeds that are being made, which spawn many health problems for dogs. He says that breeders are doing it just for money. They're creating Frankensteins without thinking at all if it's healthy for the dogs themselves. And that is it for the Fun Kids Science Weekly this week. If you've got a science question which you're desperate to get answered on the show, if you want a shout out, you need to leave it for me as a review over on Apple Podcasts. It can be about anything sciencey. Today, what do we have? We had the tilt of the earth, and we had kangaroo pouches. Wildly different things, so it doesn't matter what's going on in your brain, as long as it's sciencey, fire it over to as a review for the Science Weekly over on Apple Podcasts. I will see it. I'll do my best to do all the research for you. Also, while you're on Apple Podcasts, it's one of the best places that you can hear all of our science series. You've heard some today. We've got loads more on there for you. You can also get them on Spotify, on the free Fun Kids app, and at funkidslive.com. And Fun Kids, we're a children's radio station from the UK. You can get us all over the country on a DAB digital radio. We're on that Fun Kids app, and as always, at funkidslive.com.